Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Some criminals become infamous because of the number of their victims. Some criminals become infamous because of the methods they use in killing those victims. But the man we're talking about today became infamous because of the manner in which he died. This is the story of killer Ronnie Lee Gardner. Let's get into it. January 16th, 1961. Ronnie Lee Gardner is born in Salt Lake City, Utah, to Dan and Ruth Gardner. He was the youngest of seven children. His father was a very heavy drinker, and when Ronnie was just a toddler, Dan abandoned his family to go off with another woman. Dan and Ruth divorced, and Ronnie's first contact with the police was when he was just 2 years old. Little Ronnie was wandering the streets of Salt Lake City, malnourished and alone, dressed in nothing but a diaper. The police called Child Protective Services, who took Ronnie into custody, and filed a petition against his mother for failure to care. Ronnie was in foster care for a brief period of time and was then returned to his mother. Even though Dan had abandoned the family, Ronnie still had some contact with him. But Dan never believed that Ronnie was his biological son, and he told him that often. Ronnie was basically raised by his older sister, and later in life, he would claim that his older siblings abused him when he was young. By the time Ronnie Lee Gardner was 9 or 10 years old, he and his sister were frequently running away from home and staying in a camp with homeless people. He was using drugs and drinking by the time he was 10, and when he was a young teenager, he and his brother Randy were arrested for stealing cowboy boots. They were taken to juvenile detention, and their father was called. Dan arrived and picked up Randy. He left Dan behind. That's really awful, actually, when you think about it. Your dad comes and you think you're going to be rescued and he leaves you sitting there and takes your brother. Ronnie's mother then married this man named Bill Lucas, who was a convict, and they had two more children together. Bill used his own kids as lookouts when he went to rob houses, and Ronnie liked Bill. He romanticized this common thief as some kind of Wild West outlaw. By the time Ronnie was a teenager, he had been in and out of juvenile detention and was even once committed to the Utah State Hospital in Provo. Ronnie was small and he got picked on a lot, and he learned how to fight. He started living with this man named Jack Statt, who would dress as a woman to go to the state and procure foster kids. Back then, the state wouldn't give foster kids to a man, but they would a woman. So this man dressed up as a woman in order to take in foster kids to get the allowance from the state that they brought, and also to abuse them. Ronnie moved in with Jack and his brother Randy and all these foster kids, and Ronnie later claimed that Jack forced him into prostitution. Ronnie then met a woman named Deborah Bischoff, and they had two children together, a daughter born in May of 1977, you'll see her later on in this episode, and a son born in 1980. The same month his son was born, Ronnie Lee Gardner was sent to prison for burglary. He wasn't even there a year, and this was a maximum security prison, by the way, when he escaped. He was on the run for days and went into downtown Salt Lake City, intent on finding the man that he heard was sleeping with his girlfriend and the mother of his children. Well, he found this man and confronted him, but in the ensuing fight, the man shot him in the neck. Ronnie was then recaptured and sent back to prison. A couple of years later, he headed up a riot at the prison where inmates barricaded a cell block and started some fires. In one instance, Ronnie attacked the prison guards that he knew by name with a screwdriver when they tried to move him from cell to cell, and these guards were shocked. They said they found Ronnie to be very pleasant and thought he was friendly, but he would flip a switch and become incredibly violent very quickly. He was a real problem. He was an inmate who caused a lot of problems for his jailers, But what he'd done up to this point was child's play. Ronnie Lee Gardner was about to make himself a much, much bigger problem for everyone he came into contact with.
August 6th, 1984.
A jailer is called to Ronnie Lee Gardner's cell. Ronnie is vomiting and says he needs to go to the hospital. So he's loaded into a prison van and taken to the University of Utah Hospital in downtown Salt Lake City. Ronnie was admitted to the hospital and sat, shackled in handcuffs, in a hospital room with a lone guard awaiting treatment. Suddenly, he attacked Officer Don Levitt, the transportation officer. Ronnie hit Officer Levitt so hard in the back of the head that he almost lost consciousness. Ronnie grabbed him around the neck and told him to unlock his shackles. When the officer hesitated, Ronnie said to him, "I guess you know that if that doctor comes back, I'll have to kill you both." Officer Levitt was injured and alone, and so he unlocked the shackles. He later had to have his entire head and face reconstructed with titanium rods and wire, all for doing his job. Ronnie Lee Gardner was vicious and dangerous and violent. Ronnie took Officer Levitt's gun and ran from his hospital room. He ran to the parking lot and grabbed the first person he saw, a medical student named Mike Lynch, and shoved the gun into his side. He told Mike, "I don't want to kill you, but I have nothing to lose." He forced Mike to undress, he took his clothes, changed into them, and then demanded the keys to Mike's motorcycle. Ronnie got on that bike and rode it right out of the hospital parking lot. A manhunt ensued. Police were dispatched to look for the escaped convict, with officers being brought in from neighboring precincts to assist in the search. They looked for Ronnie all day, all week, and then all month, and they could not find him. Ronnie Lee Gardner had disappeared. For 3 months, he stayed out of sight and managed to stay free, but unbelievably never left the Salt Lake area. I find that so baffling. Why on earth would he stay in the area? If you were lucky enough to get out of prison, why wouldn't you go as far and as fast away from the site of your escape as possible? But he didn't. On October 9th, 1984, Ronnie walked into the Cheers Tavern in downtown Salt Lake. I remember that bar very clearly. I spent a lot of time in Salt Lake in the 1980s because my father served as president of the Utah State Bar and had a lot of meetings up there. And this little bar called Cheers had the same logo as the bar in the TV show. So being a kid, I thought it was the same bar. My parents watched Cheers all the time. And back then, I assumed it was filmed there in Salt Lake. You know how you are when you're a kid. You don't get it. But anyway, I remember that little bar, and I remember right where it was. Ronnie Lee Gardner walked into that bar and had a story that he was there to collect money for a friend. It seems he had been getting by kind of being an enforcer for people who sold drugs or acted as bookies. Inside the bar was Melvin Otterstrom, who had taken a second job at the bar to support his family. Melvin was just closing up the bar, and he and Ronnie got into an argument. Ronnie claims there was a struggle, but there was no evidence of a struggle. Ronnie says that the two men fought, and he decided, well, I might as well just rob the bar. Ronnie had a gun. Melvin did not. Ronnie got Melvin on the ground, put the gun to his nose, and shot him, killing him instantly. Melvin was only 37 years old. Ronnie got less than $100. I saw some footage of Ronnie's family talking about him right before his execution, and I understand that they're his family members, but some of the things being said I can't get on board with, because I think about this instance. I think about a man lying on his back in a bar being shot in cold blood, and yeah, Ronnie Lee Gardner, just an evil, evil man, evil to the core. Let me tell you just how evil he is. He went to Melvin Otterstrom's funeral pretending to be his friend. That's how evil Ronnie Lee Gardner is. So, you know, I can't help but keep that in mind when I see people saying otherwise. Ronnie fled the bar. He was driven away by his accomplice, a woman named Darcy Perry McCoy. And again, he was just free on the streets of Salt Lake City. 3 weeks later, the cops got an anonymous tip telling them that Ronnie was staying at the home of his cousin. The police surrounded his house and finally, after 3 months on the run, took him back into custody. They had Ronnie back in jail and he was going to stand trial for the murder of Melvin Otterstrom, but Ronnie Lee Gardner wasn't finished trying to escape yet. April 2nd, 1985. At the Utah State Prison, prisoners with court dates are loaded into the prison bus to be driven to the courthouse for their hearings and trials. Going in for a hearing, Ronnie Lee Gardner was among them. He was being taken for a day of testimony in his murder trial. As the prisoners were unloaded in the underground parking lot area of the courthouse, no one sees someone standing off in the distance, making eye contact with Ronnie. The prisoners were taken upstairs and into the building that houses the 3rd District Court for the state of Utah. As the prisoners were walking down the hall of the courthouses, an officer sees something in Ronnie Lee Gardner's hands. He shouts, "Run! He's got a gun!" One officer turned and ran out of the building, abandoning his post and his prisoners. The second officer pulled out a weapon and fired at Ronnie Lee Gardner, hitting him in the shoulder. People scattered and ran, and in the chaos, Ronnie ducked into a small records room off to the side of one of the courthouses. Back then, everything was stored in filing cabinets on actual paper. So in every courthouse, there were always rooms full of filing cabinets where you would have to go and pull records that you needed for your cases. And this is where Ronnie ran into to hide. There were two people in that records room who were, of course, shocked to see a man dressed in prison inmate attire, covered in blood, and carrying a gun. Ronnie said to them, "They hit me. They got me. I've been hit bad." The two men in the records room were two attorneys going through files. They were Bob Macri and his colleague, Michael Burdell. Bob thought to himself, "It's April 2nd, not the 1st, but I think this is an April Fool's joke." He was then stunned as the wounded man pointed the gun at him. The look in Ronnie's eyes told him it was no joke, and he turned to try and duck away. For some reason, Ronnie then moved the gun off of Bob Macri, pointed it at Michael Burdell, who said, "Oh my God," and shot Michael in the eye, killing him. For nothing. For absolutely nothing. Why did he do that? This is what I mean when I talk about how Ronnie was just an evil person. He was just mean. Michael Burdell was in that records room doing pro bono work, that means free legal work, for his church. And for that, he was murdered in cold blood by this monster, Ronnie Lee Gardner. Bob Macri ran from the records room yelling, "Police, help, murder." He later said, "I lost control at that point, I think." Word instantly went out over the officers' radios that there had been a shooting in the courthouse. A bailiff, a man named Nicholas Kirk, heard what was happening. His first thought was his duty, the number one duty of a bailiff, to protect their judge. Nick was assigned to Judge James Sawaya, and he knew that he had to get to him to stand guard over him because there was a madman running through the courthouse with a gun. As Nick left the bailiff's office and turned the corner into the hall, he ran right smack into Ronnie Lee Gardner, just feet away from him. The two men locked eyes, but Ronnie was already holding his gun, loaded and ready to fire. He raised it and shot Nick Kirk in the stomach. Nick fell to the floor, badly wounded. Ronnie ran past him and into the stairwell Nick had just exited. He then ran up the stairs to the main floor of the courthouse. There he came upon a man who was filling a vending machine. He pointed his gun at the man and told him, "I need a ride." The man put his hands up and nodded yes, and Ronnie and him began walking down the hallway. As they passed an open window, the vending machine employee dove out headfirst, leaving Ronnie bleeding and alone with one bullet left in his gun. Ronnie ran to the exit, opened the door, and stopped immediately in his tracks when he saw several police officers pointing their guns at him. Ronnie dropped his gun on the lawn, yelled, "Don't shoot, I don't have a gun," and surrendered to the police. In these photos, you can see Ronnie Lee Gardner in his prison-issued jumpsuit, covered in blood from his wound, being taken into custody by Salt Lake City officers. The entire escape attempt had lasted only minutes. One man was dead, and another was shot and seriously injured. Nick Kirk would suffer from those injuries for the rest of his life. Ronnie Lee Gardner was taken back to the University of Utah Hospital in serious condition. He was treated for his gunshot wound and placed in recovery. Robert Burdell still had a heartbeat, but no brain activity, and he was pronounced dead 45 minutes after his shooting while in surgery at Holy Cross Hospital. Nick Kirk, the bailiff, was taken to LDS Hospital in critical condition and went into surgery. Like I said, he survived, but his injuries caused him lifelong health problems and greatly affected the quality of his life. The courthouse went on a lockdown and a search began. During the search, a bag full of men's clothing was found under a sink in the women's restroom. One prosecutor believes that Ronnie Lee Gardner got the gun for this event in the underground parking garage of the courthouse. He believes that someone somehow managed to get the gun to Ronnie and press it into his hand without being detected. Another prosecutor believes that the gun was taped to the underside of the water fountain in the courthouse and that Ronnie grabbed the gun as he walked by that water fountain. Either way, we've got some kind of, 007 stuff going on here trying to get Ronnie this gun. Ronnie's known accomplices from his other crimes, his girlfriend and getaway driver during the murder of Melvin Otterstrom, Darcy McCoy, was found about a mile from the courthouse and she was arrested. Her sister, Karma Jolly Hainsworth, was also arrested. Authorities suspected that both of the women had helped Ronnie in his escape attempt. Darcy immediately turned state's witness and ended up testifying against Ronnie. Her sister, on the other hand, Karma, got 8 years in prison for planting the clothes in the bathroom and for relaying messages back and forth from the prison to plan the escape. Now, this case happened in Utah, like I said, where I was born and raised. And I asked my father about this case to see if he could remember anything specific, any extra insight. At this time, he was an attorney in Cedar City, Utah, which is about 5 hours south of Salt Lake City. But he went to court a lot in Salt Lake and he knew some of the people involved. He said, "I remember that Ronnie Lee Gardner is an evil man, and I remember that this forever changed the way prisoners are transported to and from court. They made a lot of changes after this, and they were needed changes." Salt Lake City Sheriff Pete Hayward was very critical of the guard who shot Ronnie, saying he should have kept shooting until Ronnie was dead. But after speaking to witnesses, it was found that the guard couldn't keep shooting because Ronnie was using other people around him as human shields. Sheriff Howard then blamed the breach of security on the layout of the courthouse, which was called the Metropolitan Hall of Justice, saying that the layout allowed unrestricted access to areas where prisoners are transported. So yes, like my dad said, there were things that needed changing there at the courthouse. Ronnie Lee Gardner was placed back in maximum security and was set to go to trial. In preparation for that trial, he was examined by a psychiatrist who diagnosed him with antisocial personality disorder. In June of 1985, Ronnie pleaded guilty to the murder of Melvin Otterstrom and received a life sentence without the possibility of parole. Again, Ronnie made a problem of himself, saying he was going to cause a scene in front of the jury if they didn't take the leg irons off of him. Well, they had put those leg irons off of him because he kept trying to run away. Ronnie was then advised that if he acted up in front of the jury, it would do nothing but delay the proceedings and cause them to drag out. In his subsequent trial, on October 22, 1985, the jury found Ronnie Lee Gardner guilty of capital murder in the death of Robert Burdell. They sentenced him to death. Ronnie was sent off to death row and he had nothing but time to think. And the next time he appeared in court, he had something to say. November 1985. Ronnie Lee Gardner appears in court and informs the judge that he has decided he wants to be executed by firing squad. He said, "I'd prefer to die of old age, Your Honor, but if that ain't possible, I'll take the firing squad." Now, if you watch this channel, you'll remember the case of Gary Gilmore, another Utah man who was executed by firing squad in 1977. Back in 1985, there were only a handful of states still using the firing squad as a method of execution. And my friends, this will probably shock you, or maybe it won't. Utah still uses the firing squad. Today, in 2022, Utah and Oklahoma are the only two states in America where the use of a firing squad to carry out a state-sanctioned execution is still an option. It is the wild, wild west here, my friends. There's actually a legal battle being waged right now in South Carolina because a prisoner there is demanding to be executed by firing squad, which is something South Carolina has never done. Richard Moore was set to be executed on April 29th, 2022, but it didn't happen. Whenever a prisoner makes this request, it causes upheaval in the court systems, and it definitely did that when Ronnie Lee Gardner made his request. This request set into motion the usual set of appeals, and Ronnie was sent back to prison to wait. While he was there, he continued to be a massive problem for his jailers. In 1987, Ronnie Lee Gardner was visiting with a woman who had come to see him at the prison. These guys never have a shortage of women. It is fascinating and disturbing to me. Some people need their heads examined. So he's sitting there talking with this woman through the glass. Suddenly he breaks the glass partition between them, grabs the woman, and begins undressing her. When the other prisoners saw this, they barricaded the doors closed so the guards couldn't get to Ronnie. And they're like cheering him on, and him and the woman. Yeah. It took some time for the guards to get past the barricades and get to Ronnie, but they did. In 1994, Ronnie, drunk on prison toilet wine, stabbed his fellow inmate, Richard Fats Thomas, with a shiv that he'd made from a pair of sunglasses. Richard Thomas was stabbed 9 times, but made a full recovery. Ronnie was charged with another capital crime for that incident. Just a bad guy. A bad guy all the way around. And that's about the nicest way I can put it. In February of 1996, in a scheduled hearing, Ronnie Lee Gardner said he would sue the state of Utah if it refused to execute him by firing squad. He told the judge, "I like the firing squad. It's so much easier and there's no mistakes." Some defense attorneys then took up Ronnie's case and began filing motions stating he could not be executed because he had brain damage. They said he was the victim of child abuse and neglect, and that his brain had been affected by a serious case of meningitis that Ronnie contracted when he was 4 years old. Ronnie had also spent years huffing gas and glue with his siblings, and they claim this further damaged his brain. Ronnie then began claiming that he was a changed man. He became a counselor for other inmates and even wrote a letter to Oprah Winfrey asking that she donate money to help him start an organic farm at the prison. Ronnie Lee Gardner had seemingly changed his mind about wanting to be executed.
"I can do a lot of good. I really believe that I can. First of all, I'm a good example. There's no better example in this state of what not to do."
The Board of Parole listened to the arguments and reviewed the filings, but ultimately decided that Ronnie Lee Gardner's sentence would stand. Requests for commutation were denied, and soon his execution was scheduled. First, the state had to build what it needed to carry out the execution. A former Utah corrections director had written a manual in 1985 describing how to conduct executions by firing squad, and the state would use that manual as its instructions to carry out Ronnie's execution. Inside a small concrete room in the prison, a wall was constructed. In that wall, a long horizontal opening was included to serve as a resting place for the barrels of the rifles that would be placed through it, protrude through it, and pointed at Ronnie Lee Gardner. 5 officers would then stand behind the wall, would each be given a prison-issued rifle for the execution. One of those rifles would be loaded with a blank, not a bullet. That way, there would always be some doubt in each of the officers' minds whether or not they were the one who fired the bullets that shot Ronnie. The identities of these volunteers is never released. It is always kept a secret. A large, sturdy wooden and metal chair was constructed for just this purpose. On it were straps for the ankles, wrists, and head. It was placed in front of a concrete block wall. Following the instructions in the execution manual, sandbags were filled and stacked behind and to the sides of the chair to catch any possible ricochet that may occur during the shooting. The media reported on the execution, and the public interest was great, considering the method that was being used.
Ronnie Lee Gardner killed a defense attorney in a Utah courthouse in 1985. He got the death penalty, and this is how he will die tonight. Just before midnight, Gardner will be led into the death chamber and seated facing a wall about 20 feet away. A target will be pinned to his jumpsuit over his heart. He'll offer his last words, then be hooded. And then, behind a long port in the wall, 5 shooters armed with Winchester 30 caliber rifles, one randomly loaded with a blank round, so no one can know for sure if he fired a fatal shot. They'll take aim, and after a brief countdown, blast Ronnie Lee Gardner out of this life. Utah is the last state that still conducts executions by firing squad. Reporter Amy Donaldson witnessed the last firing squad execution of John Albert Taylor in 1996.
The boom of the guns and his fists clenched and then unclenched and clenched a little bit, and then his head fell forward.
And then there was Gary Gilmore, whose execution in Utah in 1977, the first after the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty, was a sensation. His last words immortalized in a TV movie.
Let's do it.
Some opponents of capital punishment are horrified by the firing squad, seeing it as a cruel relic of Old West justice. But many experts say it is quicker and surer than other methods.
People think that lethal injection is more humane because it's related to medicine and doctors and a peaceful way of death. But in reality, it's not.
Ronnie Lee Gardner has said he chose the firing squad because, as he put it, there's no mistakes.
The shooters in the firing squad tonight are volunteers from local law enforcement in Utah. All will be offered counseling after the execution, and they will be getting something else from the state of Utah as well. Each will be given a specially minted commemorative coin to honor the duty they perform.
24 hours before the execution, with everything prepared, Ronnie Lee Gardner was moved from his 6-by-12-foot maximum security cell on death row to a cell that they call the death watch cell that is monitored constantly by a guard. Ronnie Lee Gardner was offered his last meal, which I will, of course, show you and taste on an episode coming to my playlist, Dining with the Damned, in the future. He was allowed to see his requested visitors and was allowed time with a spiritual advisor. Ronnie's family stood vigil across the street from the prison. They said Ronnie did not want them to be at the execution. They comforted each other and they sang songs and they talked to the press.
My name is Brandy Gardner. I am Ronnie Lee Gardner's daughter. I'm sad. I'm honestly a little numb. It's a little bit surreal right now. I just think that he has the prettiest eyes I've ever seen, and he just has a great smile, a warming smile. My dad believes in the death penalty, and he believes in an eye for an eye. And he believes, you know, he shot and killed people, and he believes that he should be shot and killed.
Ronnie was then changed out of his usual prison attire and was placed in a black jumpsuit, which is reserved for executions. He was then led to the 20-by-24-foot execution chamber. He was strapped to that special chair constructed just for this event, made of metal and wood, with a mesh seat. A metal tray was attached below the mesh seat to collect his blood. Once Ronnie was strapped in, the curtains were opened so that the witnesses could see the execution. Ronnie was asked if he had any last words, and he said, "I do not, no." A paper target was placed over Ronnie's heart, and a black hood was placed over his head. The rifles, bench rested for accuracy, were taken off of safety mode, and the executioner said, "Ready, aim, fire." The five gunmen pulled their triggers, and the bullets found their mark. Ronnie Lee Gardner's hands clenched into fists. He sat upright very tall. He seemed to relax, but then again he clenched his fists very tight. And then a few seconds later, his hands relaxed and his head slumped to one side. He was dead. Here is a clip of the first-hand accounts of the witnesses who were there.
The first was when the curtain was opened. Mr. Gardner's head was restrained. There was a strap across his forehead so he couldn't move his head. But I could see him moving his eyes. And it looked almost like he could see us through the window, even though he couldn't.
What caught my attention was that it was so sudden, so quick, boom, boom, just like that.
It was over pretty quickly. It was cleaner than I expected, and it was fast. But he moved. He moved a little bit, and to some degree that bothers me. To some degree, that mirrors the last few weeks of his life, because he was fighting to stay alive the last few weeks of his life legally, and that seemed to carry on the last 60 to 120 seconds.
The debate over the death penalty rages on. We are pretty divided on how we feel about it, and we are even more divided on whether or not a firing squad, such an archaic method of execution, should still be in use. But one thing I think we can all agree on, Ronnie Lee Gardner was an evil and dangerous man, and the world is a safer place now that he's gone. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you liked the video and subscribe to my channel if you'd like to support me. The other thing you can do to support me is join my Patreon. It helps immensely. Stay safe and be kind to each other, and I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Alo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.